Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's story is one that is going to be kind of long. And if you're choosing to watch this on YouTube, it's probably a good idea. There's a lot of names and faces that you're going to want to remember. But this is a case that I came across and I kind of heard it in multiple circles and I just didn't know much about it. And then once I kind of started, it's like an onion. It just has all these layers and aspects to this story that really make it a true tragedy. So I want to hear your thoughts on what you think about this entire story by the end. Today, we are talking about the tragic life of Stephen Stayner. In the late 1960s and early 70s, Delbert and Kay Stayner were raising five kids in Merced, California, a Central Valley town often called the Gateway to Yosemite. The siblings were Carrie, who was the oldest, then three sisters, Cindy, Jody, and Corey, and then the youngest son, Stephen Gregory Stayner, born April 18th of 1965. Delbert was a U.S. Army veteran who worked long stretches in canneries after stints in sawmills. He logged decades at California Canners and Growers, and later at Atwater Canning before he eventually retired. The family home life was a working class, steady family. They went to church on Sundays, school during the week, kids playing outside till dinner. And then tragedy hit in December of 1972. It was a Monday afternoon in early December when 7-year-old Stephen left Charles Wright Elementary and started his familiar walk home. On the way, a man named Irvin Edward Murphy, who was new to town and described later by acquaintances as naive and easily led, struck up a conversation with Stephen. Murphy said he was collecting items for a church and asked whether Stephen's mom might have anything to donate. When Stephen said yes, Murphy asked where he lived and if Stephen could show him. Turns out Irvin Murphy was enlisted by a man named Kenneth Parnell. The two had worked together at a resort in Yosemite National Park at the time, and Kenneth was presenting himself as an aspiring minister. Irvin was instructed to pass out religious tracts to boys who were walking home from school that day. So when Irvin approached 7-year-old Stephen asking about donations, and Stephen said yes, that he thought his mom might have something to donate, that's when a white Buick pulled up driven by Kenneth Eugene Parnell, who was actually a 41-year-old night clerk with a criminal past. Stephen willingly got into that Buick, and he did not go home. Kenneth drove not to a church, but to a small cabin in Cathy's Valley, a rural spot in Mariposa County, shockingly only a few hundred feet from Stephen's maternal grandfather's property, which is a detail that the young boy would not learn until later. That first night cemented the dynamic. Kenneth Parnell began sexual abuse almost immediately, and within weeks told Stephen a series of lies that a judge had granted Parnell custody because his parents had too many children, and that his name was now going to be Dennis Gregory Parnell, and that home was not home anymore. He kept Stephen's real middle name and birth date to ease school enrollments as they moved. Stephen asked Kenneth repeatedly if he could go back home, but Kenneth would tell him the same story, that he couldn't go home because his parents didn't want him back and that a judge had signed off on Kenneth obtaining custody of him. And 7-year-old Stephen could not have known that that was a lie. So just imagine that, being 7 years old and you've been taken by this old man who not only tells you that you can't go home, your parents don't want you anymore, and on top of it all, he is introduced to sex in the most horrific way as a child. It's truly too much to bear hearing it or saying it as an adult. Imagine what it was like for that young boy. Now, allow me to tell you a little bit more about this monster, Kenneth Parnell. Parnell's background matters because it explains both his method and his mobility. Born in 1931 in Amarillo, Texas, he grew up mostly without his father, who left the family when he was around 6 years old, and cycled through juvenile custody for theft and arson. In March of 1951, he was arrested for abducting and sexually assaulting a young boy while impersonating a police officer. He had obtained a deputy's badge from an Army-Navy store. He was sentenced to only a few years in prison, briefly escaped from a state facility in Norwalk, and then was recaptured. In the years that followed, he accumulated more trouble, including an armed robbery conviction in Utah. By the early 70s, he was in California again, working transient jobs, among them a night auditor job at the Yosemite Lodge, where he had met Irvin Murphy, whom he'd recruited into Stephen's kidnapping under the cover story that he was a minister seeking to raise a boy. After the abduction, Parnell constructed a new identity for Stephen as Dennis. He enrolled him in schools under that name and toggled between strictness and indulgence, like corporal punishment one week and then permissive freedom and gifts the next. He allowed alcohol early on and cigarettes. He gave Stephen a small Manchester Terrier named Queenie that was reportedly a gift from Parnell's mother, who did not know that Kenneth had a young boy in his possession. But Kenneth used this puppy as another prop to normalize the abnormal. Stephen would ask to go home, and the answer was always manipulation cloaked as law. A judge gave me custody, he would say, and the abuse continued. Parnell preferred small communities where questions drew fewer echoes. They lived in Mariposa County, then Santa Rosa, which was Sonoma County, and then later remote Mendocino County hamlets like Comanche. Stephen attended school as Dennis and learned, as many long-term abducted children do, to navigate the invented family story to avoid punishment or suspicion. For roughly 18 months between 1975 and 1977, a woman named Barbara Mathias lived with Parnell and Stephen. And according to later accounts, Barbara Mathias participated in sexual assaults on young Stephen and, at Parnell's direction, attempted to lure another child, someone Stephen knew from the Santa Rosa Boys Club, into a car. But the attempt failed. Mathias would later claim she didn't know that Dennis was a kidnapped child. Prosecutors never charged her, and she cooperated during later proceedings, which we'll get to. Parnell also tried to recruit Stephen into helping him kidnap other children. Stephen later said that he deliberately sabotaged those attempts, failing on purpose to keep other kids from suffering the same fate. As Stephen grew older, Parnell's sexual interest waned, and the search for a younger boy became an obvious interest. By 1978 to 79, Stephen was about 13 or 14 years old, and they were living in Northern California's Redwood Country near places like Comanche and Manchester, like Point Arena along the Mendocino coast. Parnell's attention was increasingly focused on finding a younger child. He floated schemes, tried and failed to abduct boys, and leaned on teenagers around Stephen to help him. In early 1980, he asked Randall Sean Poorman, a teenager who knew Stephen, to assist. Poorman accepted small payments and contraband. Accounts reference cash, marijuana, and alcohol as a receipt, I guess, for in exchange for helping Parnell obtain a young boy. And on February 14th, Valentine's Day of 1980, Parnell and Poorman abducted 5-year-old Timothy, or Timmy, White from Ukiah. Now 14, Stephen watched his own worst years about to begin for a kindergartner, and he decided that he would not allow it. So on the night of March 1st, 1980, Parnell left for a night shift at a nearby motel. Stephen took Timmy by the hand, and some accounts say that he even carried him on piggyback part of the way, and he set out to get that little boy home. They hitchhiked toward Ukiah, roughly 40 or 50 miles from the coastal area. And not to mention, it's the middle of the night, it's pitch black, the weather was bad, and there was absolutely nothing that was going to stop Stephen from getting Timmy back home. Not knowing the exact address, they walked into the Ukiah police station close to midnight and asked for help. Officers initially thought they had a teenage runaway and a youngster, and a check of missing child bulletins and sustained questioning unraveled it. Dennis was actually Stephen Stainer, abducted 7 years earlier from Merced. The younger child was Timmy White, who was snatched 2 weeks prior. By daybreak on March 2nd of 1980, Parnell was in custody. Both boys finally went home that same day. But of course, home as they knew it would never be the same. 8 years had passed and Stephen's family had naturally struggled with his disappearance. The abduction had fractured the Stainers' sense of safety. Dell, his father, oscillated between hope and despair. He felt responsible for not spending more time with Stephen and became very depressed. His temper flared more easily under the weight of so much guilt. He spent his nights scanning crowds in magazines and on television, telling reporters that he never stopped looking and always searched faces, hoping that one might be Stephen. When they drove through the mountains and valleys, Dell would keep his eyes out and peeled for freshly disturbed dirt, convinced that Stephen was probably gone, but that he could at least find his grave. Kay, his mother, raised in a Catholic boarding school, clung to prayer, and she often came off as somewhat stoic and very strong, composed, and, you know, kept together. She kept Stephen's clothes laid out on his bed for months and saved every birthday and Christmas gift that he missed opening. And she actually confessed to reporters that she wanted to see him tear off the wrapping paper when he eventually came home. She never gave up hope that he would eventually return. Even when friends urged her to stop torturing herself, she refused to give up hope. But, you know, side note, anyone telling you to stop torturing yourself by holding out hope that your kidnapped, missing child could return home alive is not your friend, okay? Now, with four children still at home, Kay tried to manage and maintain routines. Carrie, the oldest brother, who was then 10 at the time of the disappearance, retreated into drawing and nature walks and would wish on a star each night that his brother would come home. Friends recall him as a sensitive boy who pulled out his own hair when he was really stressed and had trouble forming friendships. Younger sister Cindy became a quiet presence, and she continued school and chores, but family talk revolved around Stephen. Jody and Corey were toddlers and grew up in a home where their brother's face stared back from the missing child posters on the refrigerator. The family's strict telephone rule meant that none of the children learned their home number, a tragic oversight that later prevented Stephen from contacting them when, as Dennis Parnell, he tried to call home from a payphone in Santa Rosa. Community response was vigorous at first. Merced police canvassed neighborhoods and, according to news reports, mounted a significant search, but there were no leads. Neighbors brought casseroles and watched the Stainer kids so that Dell and Kay could search outlying areas, and yet suspicion also crept in. Detectives polygraphed Dell and Kay and rummaged through their home for any evidence that maybe they could be behind this. A psychic pointed to Kathy's Valley near Kay's father's ranch, where he was, as the place where Stephen's body might be. But it was a dead end that strained already tense family relations. As years passed without answers, the search effort moved from active canvassing to a quiet vigilance. The Stainers continued to celebrate Stephen's birthday, each time adding another wrapped present to the pile that they refused to open. Dell remained on what daughter Cynthia later described as a mission. When he wasn't working, he scanned faces and crowds, pinned maps on the wall, and pursued every rumor. This quest consumed him and, according to Cynthia, took attention away from the other children. Carrie, now an adolescent, felt invisible. Friends recall his hair-pulling compulsion worsening and his inability to connect with his friends and his classmates, so he spent hours at the Merced River just drawing nature scenes. Kay shouldered the household load. She made sure that the kids were in church every Sunday. She tended a backyard garden to help stretch Dell's paycheck and worked part-time cleaning houses. Even though she tried to present a brave face, she admitted she was drawn to Stephen's bedroom because his clothes and toys made her feel close to him. When the children needed new shoes or extra money for school trips, Kay sold homemade jams and crocheted items at church fairs. The extended family offered little support. In fact, Kay's father thought that she and Dell were irresponsible for having so many children and criticized their finances. There were also repeated traumas. Every time news broke about a child's body being found, police called the Stainers and asked them to identify photographs. Each time, they refused to look, hoping that the remains were not Stephen's. The siblings adapted differently. Cindy became a second mother to her younger brothers, helping Kay with chores and homework. Jody, who was shy and artistic, withdrew into books. Corey, the youngest, never knew life without a missing brother. The children formed a tight unit, but grew up under constant vigilance. Curfews were strict. They walked to school in pairs, and they were not allowed to answer the door for anyone except for family. When unsympathetic classmates asked about Stephen or insinuated that he had run away, Carrie and Cindy reacted with anger. Despite their differences, the siblings shared one unspoken rule. They never stopped waiting for Stephen. So on March 1st of 1980, when Stephen came home, the world that they knew was rocked once again. He had arrived at the Ukiah police station with a 5-year-old boy, Timothy White, and explained that he had escaped his kidnapper. That evening in Merced, Kay answered the door to hear a gruff male voice say, "I've got your boy." And initially, she thought the cops were there regarding Carrie because Carrie had been camping, but they said, "No, it's about Steve." Kay, who had held out hope all these years, literally never wavering in that hope, ironically thought in that moment that she was about to receive the worst news, that Stephen was dead, only to find out that Steve was alive and he was coming home. The reunion was chaotic, to say the least, with hundreds of people swarming the Stainer home, flashing lights from reporters and people clamoring just to get into Steve's proximity. Photographs from the reunion show his older brother, Carrie, kind of standing in the background off to the side, his arms crossed, unsmiling. According to neighbors, he looked unhappy that cameras were pointed at his brother rather than him. And in later interviews, Carrie admitted that he felt estranged after 7 years as the eldest son. He suddenly had to share a room with a brother he barely knew. Within hours, television crews camped out on their lawn. Reporters were climbing onto the roof, taking pictures through their windows, and neighbors poured into the yard. Can you imagine? I feel like now, like in today's time, that is just not something that would happen. Now we have better boundaries in place, probably thanks to laws. But when I think of, for example, the Brian Laundrie and Gabby Petito case, just off the top of my head, how they were camped out in the street, but, you know, off the property line from the Laundrie residence, I just think about the similarities and the differences. So I just can't imagine welcoming my son home after 8 years of being gone and being bombarded with these people on my property. I can't. But Kay later recalled wanting to share their joy, but feeling trapped by the constant media presence and helicopters hovering overhead. She begged the press to leave, but their home became a circus for weeks. Corey described wanting to return to normal, but being unable to because there were cameras in the kitchen and strangers in their backyard. In the midst of the frenzy, Kay realized that Stephen needed counseling to process the trauma of repeated sexual abuse and years of manipulation, but Dell dismissed the idea, saying that his son did not need therapy. This, of course, was, you know, the 80s, and this is, you know, coming off the heels of this generation that really didn't talk about feelings. You stiffened your upper lip and you just powered through. We didn't talk about emotions. So I don't want you to automatically assume that Dell is this awful guy. I think sometimes these parents are just doing the best with the tools they have that they were raised with, right? So publicly, Stephen was celebrated as a hero. He threw out the first pitch at a baseball game and appeared on Good Morning America, telling the world that he had changed so much and that he did not recognize his siblings. Privately, though, he grappled with these dissonant roles. Raised under Parnell's loose rules, allowed to smoke, drink, and skip school, he struggled with the Stainers' strict household and bristled when Kay treated him like a 7-year-old. In a 1984 Newsweek interview, he confessed that although he came home almost a grown man, his parents made him do the typing class and the fundamentals again, and he wondered why his father never hugged him anymore. And sometimes he asked himself whether he should have returned. School was brutal. Classmates mocked him for having been molested, calling him slurs, like homophobic slurs, after he had just been molested by his kidnapper for years, since 7 years old. And he eventually dropped out. He began drinking and, according to his sister Corey, made jokes about his ordeal to mask his pain. Stephen's adjustment also exposed fault lines in the family. Kay said he came back very different and admitted that the family had a rough time adjusting. His independence often clashed with Dell's expectations. Arguments erupted over curfews and chores. Carrie, by then a high school senior, continued to retreat inward. Decades later, he would testify that during the years that Stephen was missing, he felt ignored, and Cynthia confirmed that their father's mission to find Stephen had left little emotional bandwidth for the other children. The younger siblings wavered between awe and discomfort. They were thrilled that their brother was home, but unsettled by his celebrity and unsettled by the tension between their parents. There were good moments too, Stephen roughhousing in the yard with his brothers, family picnics where he and Carrie actually smiled together, and Kay's relief at finally having all five children under one roof. Yet the undercurrent of unresolved trauma never faded, and it never does. It never does, you guys. You gotta treat this stuff. In 1985, at about 20 years old, Stephen married Jody Edmondson. They had two children together, Ashley and Stephen Jr. They actually met at work. He was working as a butcher at the time, but he was kind of going between odd jobs. And so they met when he was working for a butcher. And in addition to working locally, he also kept speaking with kids about safety and abduction, sometimes with Timmy White at his side, as the two shared a survivor-rescuer bond. Friends and family describe him as private in some ways, but openly affectionate with his kids and so proud of being a dad. And then, tragically, on a Saturday evening in Merced in 1989, as Stephen rode his motorcycle home from work, a driver turned in front of him and Stephen collided with the truck. The collision was severe, but the driver took off, and Stephen, only 24 years old, died at the scene. The driver was eventually found and later received a short custodial sentence for hit and run and was acquitted of manslaughter. And the public grief was immediate and large. There was a packed funeral, heavy media presence, and a sense that a hard-won life had been cut tragically short. So now let's talk about the justice in this case. Authorities quickly discovered Parnell's 1951 sodomy conviction and built kidnapping cases in multiple venues. Parnell was tried in separate proceedings for the abductions of Stephen as a Merced County case, and then Timmy as an Alameda County venue for legal reasons tied to the evidence and witnesses. He was convicted in 1981 and 1982 and received, get this, a 7-year sentence. He served about 5 before parole. The system never charged him for the sexual assaults against Stephen, largely because most of those crimes occurred in different counties or were time barred or outside the trial court's jurisdiction. Now, Irvin Murphy, the man who first approached Stephen, was sentenced to 5 years and paroled after approximately 2. Sean Poorman, the friend of Stephen's who helped grab Timmy, received a juvenile work camp term. Barbara Mathias was never charged. And ultimately, Stephen spent more time abducted than his abductor spent in jail for it. Just let that sink in. Now, despite serving minimal time for the kidnappings, Parnell reemerged in the news decades later. To nobody's surprise, the slap-on-the-wrist sentence taught this prick nothing, and in 2003, in his 70s and living in the East Bay, he tried to procure a young boy, asking his caregiver's sister to help obtain a child for $500. So she went to the police, and then a sting followed. In 2004, a jury convicted Parnell of attempted child purchasing and attempted molestation. Under California's three strikes law, the sentence was 25 to life, which is what it should have been in the first place, but he died in prison in 2008. Timmy White, by then an adult and later an LA County Sheriff's deputy, testified at that trial. After his rescue, Timmy's family remained in touch with the Stainers. As a teenager, Timmy served as a pallbearer at Stephen's funeral. He married, had children, and became a deputy sheriff. And on April 1st of 2010, Timmy White died of a pulmonary embolism at the age of 35. That same year, Merced dedicated a bronze statue in Applegate Park depicting teenage Stephen leading 5-year-old Timmy by hand, a public memorial to a teenager's decision to take a child home. Now, I have to kind of go back a little bit because this wasn't the first time that they had actually talked about putting up a statue to honor Stephen and his legacy. In the decade after Stephen's death, Merced discussed honoring him with a city park. And when the process finally moved forward around 1999 to 2000, another breaking story froze it in its tracks. Stephen's older brother, Kerry, was arrested and later convicted in the murders of four women in and near Yosemite National Park. So city officials ultimately declined to name a park Stayner Park, concerned that the name would be indelibly synonymous to the crimes rather than Stephen's rescue of Timmy White.
Organic, farm-grown, never lab-made, these are the ultra-premium CBD gummies from Secret Nature, crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to support your day with clean, purposeful functionality. For me, I like keeping a Bliss gummy on hand when I've got a packed schedule and need steady focus without that jittery feeling. It's just clean, balanced energy that helps me stay in the zone. And when the day is over, I reach for a snoozer's gummy to actually unwind and put a real stop to my day. It feels intentional and it slides right into my routine. And here's what sets them apart. They're organic, farm-grown, and never lab-made, ultra-premium CBD gummies with real botanicals, nothing extra. And you have two options. You have Bliss for clear focus and productive flow, and then you have Snoozers for rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's no guessing. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 30% off. That's secretnature.com, code MAMA. Have you ever felt like no matter how much you rest, you're still just running on empty? Fatigue, brain fog, even brittle nails, those can all be signs of iron deficiency. And here's the thing, iron deficiency is way more common than people realize. It affects about 1 in 3 adults, especially women, and traditional iron supplements usually don't cut it. They're hard to absorb, and they often leave you dealing with nausea, constipation, or a metallic-y taste. That's why I recommend Citerol from PharmaNutra. Citerol is a premium iron supplement made with patented sucrosomial technology, which basically wraps the iron in a protective shield so your body can absorb it 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And the best part is it's gentle on the stomach. There's no nausea, no constipation, and no metallic taste. Citerol has been clinically studied, over 150 published studies, in fact, and it's trusted by more than 2 million people worldwide. It's Italy's number one supplement brand and is finally available here in the U.S. Just one capsule a day with water anytime, with or without food, and you're good to go. So if you're nodding along because you're exhausted, foggy, or just tired of feeling tired, this could be exactly what you've been missing. Head to pharmanutra-us.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Citerol. That's pharmanutra-us.com with the code MAMA, M-A-M-A, for 10% off today.
Now, Kerry's case is its own separate story, but I have to include it here for you to get the full picture of what this entire family went through. Kerry was only 11 when everything in his world changed. During the time Stephen was missing, Kerry was essentially the forgotten son. While his parents poured all their energy into finding Stephen, Kerry was left to process the trauma alone. People who knew him later said that he became more and more introverted, withdrawn, quiet, and a little odd. He started pulling out his own hair, which is a condition known as trichotillomania, and always wore a hat to cover the bald patches. When Stephen came home in 1980, it was a miracle for the Stayner family, but it was also complicated. Stephen had changed, and so had Kerry. Stephen became the focus of national media attention, interviews, television, television specials, school talks. In fact, there was a show made that was called I Know My First Name is Stephen, and it was a miniseries that was actually nominated for, I think, 4 Emmys. And tragically, Stephen Stayner's motorcycle accident was the night before the Emmys. All of that is to say that there was plenty of media attention, but it was all about Stephen, and Kerry faded further into the background. Some relatives said that resentment started to build during this time, though no one could have imagined where it would lead. After high school, Carey floated between jobs. He worked as a mechanic, then as a handyman, and eventually took maintenance work at a small motel near Yosemite National Park called Cedar Lodge in El Portal, California. Coworkers describe him as polite but odd, sometimes friendly, sometimes kind of standoffish and rude. He had a reputation for being a loner, often hiking alone in Yosemite and spending hours sketching wildlife or just sitting quietly by the river. By this point, Carey was in his 30s and living a pretty solitary life. In 1990, tragedy hit again when his uncle, Jesse Stainer, was found murdered at home, shot to death. The case was never solved, and Carey later claimed that Jesse had molested him as a child, though police never confirmed whether that was true or if it had anything to do with Jesse's death. Around that time, Carey began using marijuana and experimenting with hallucinogens. He also told later psychiatrists that he had violent sexual fantasies about abducting and killing women dating back to childhood. By early 1999, Carey was working full-time as a handyman at Cedar Lodge, a rustic motel just outside Yosemite National Park that catered to tourists. And on February 15th of 1999, three guests checked in. Carol Sund, who was a 42-year-old school teacher from Eureka, California, Julie Sund, who was Carol's 15-year-old daughter, and Silvina Peloso, a 16-year-old exchange student from Argentina who was staying with the Sund family. They were there for a short trip, just sightseeing, hiking, enjoying the park. When they didn't show up for their flight home, their families reported them missing. For weeks, there were no leads. Then, on March 18th of 99, investigators found a rented red Pontiac Grand Prix burned beyond recognition in the Sierra Nevada foothills. In the trunk were the charred bodies of two people, and dental records later confirmed they were Carol Sund and Silvina Peloso. However, Julie was still missing. A few days later, a map and a note were sent to police. The note said, quote, "We had fun with this one," and included a crude drawing marking where Julie's body could be found. So 6 weeks after she went missing, search teams followed the directions to a remote area near Lake Don Pedro, where they found Julie Sun's body. Her throat had been slit, and she was wrapped in a blanket from Cedar Lodge Resort, where Carey worked. At the time, investigators were flooded with false leads. The FBI initially suspected a group of men connected to a local drug ring. Those men were questioned and even arrested briefly before being cleared. Meanwhile, Carey Stainer, the motel's handyman who had easy access to the victim's rooms, wasn't yet on anyone's radar. Months later, in July of 99, a young naturalist named Joey Ruth Armstrong, who was 26 years old, was living in Yosemite while working for the park's environmental education program. She was known for her kindness and her love of wildlife. On July 21st, Joey was preparing to leave for a weekend trip when she was attacked outside of her cabin in the Foresta area of Yosemite. When she didn't arrive at her friend's home that evening, coworkers grew worried. The next day, park rangers found a horrifying scene. Joey's body had been dumped near a creek, decapitated, and her head was found a short distance away. Investigators now believed they had a serial killer in Yosemite. Witnesses reported seeing a powder blue 1970s International Scout near Joey's cabin around the time of her disappearance, and that vehicle belonged to Carey Stainer. By late July, the FBI was closing in. Agents traced Carey to a nudist resort near Sacramento called Laguna del Sol, where he was staying. He was arrested there on July 24th of 99. At first, he denied having any involvement, but once in custody, he asked to speak to an FBI agent alone. He told the agent he wanted to get everything off his chest, but only if he was promised access to child sexual abuse material in exchange for his confession. The agents refused, naturally, but he kept him talking. And within hours, Carey confessed to all four murders: Joey Armstrong, Carol and Julie Sund, and Silvina Peloso. He described in chilling detail how he had committed each one. According to his confession, the murder started with an impulse. He told investigators that on the night of February 15th, he went to the Cedar Lodge, knocked on the door of the women's room, and claimed that he needed to fix a ventilation problem. Once inside, he pulled out a gun. He tied up Carol and Sylvina, forced them onto the bed, and made them watch as he sexually assaulted Julie. He then strangled both of those women. He kept Julie alive for several hours, driving her to a remote spot near Lake Don Pedro, where he killed her by slitting her throat. In Joey Armstrong's case, he said he spotted her walking alone outside her cabin and decided to act on impulse again. He abducted her at knife point, forced her into his vehicle, but when she tried to escape, he chased her down, slashed her throat, and then later returned to the scene to fully decapitate her body. Because Joey Armstrong's murder occurred on federal land, Carrie was charged in federal court first. He pleaded guilty to her murder and received a life sentence without parole to avoid the death penalty. But the other three murders of Carol, Julie, and Sylvina were prosecuted in California state court. His defense claimed that he had suffered from severe mental illness, obsessive compulsive disorder, paraphilia, and a long history of trauma. They argued that growing up in the shadow of his brother's kidnapping had permanently damaged him. And let's just stop for a second, because if you think that damaged Carrie, what do you think Stephen went through? And yet Stephen didn't grow up to become a serial killer. So I just have no sympathy for this guy anymore. And prosecutors agree with me. They said he was manipulative, calculating, and fully aware of what he was doing. So on August 27th of 2002, a jury convicted Carrie Stainer of 3 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances and 1 count of kidnapping. That December, the same jury sentenced him to death. Carrie Stainer has remained on death row at San Quentin State Prison ever since. California has not carried out an execution since 2006, and Governor Gavin Newsom later imposed a moratorium, so Carrie is unlikely to be executed anytime soon. He's now in his 60s, and he continues to appeal his conviction, though all major appeals have been denied. Over the years, investigators have quietly revisited several cold cases to see if Carrie might be linked to them as well. One case often mentioned is that of Patricia Hicks Dahlstrom, a 28-year-old woman whose dismembered remains were found in Yosemite in the 1980s. The method, partial dismemberment, disposal in the park, had eerie similarities to Carrie's crimes, but there's never been enough evidence to charge him. And Carrie has never admitted to any other murders beyond the 4 that he was convicted of. Now, the Stainer's family story is almost beyond comprehension. One son kidnapped and held captive for 7 years, another son 2 decades later convicted of serial murder. For the family, it was another devastating chapter in a long novel of trauma. Their father, Delbert, once said in an interview, quote, "One son brought us tragedy when he was taken, another brought it when he gave tragedy to others." Today, Carrie remains behind bars, and Stephen's legacy, rescuing a child and ending his abductor's crimes, continues to be honored through memorials and documentaries. It's a story that stretches across decades, raising haunting questions about nature versus nurture, which is something that Austin and I talk about all the time, just our thoughts on it, and I'd love to hear yours too. But, it raises questions of nature versus nurture, and what really happens when a family never fully heals. Now, after learning about this story in its entirety, I felt compelled to recognize a distinction between Carrie and Stephen that I thought, I don't know if you guys will see this too, but the first thing that came to mind was the story of Cain and Abel from the Bible. Now, if you're familiar with it or not, a quick recap is that in the book of Genesis, Cain and Abel represent 2 opposing forces. Abel is the innocent and favored son who earns God's approval, and Cain, who becomes consumed by jealousy, feeling overlooked and unappreciated. And I felt like there were some parallels between these 2 pairs of brothers. In the Stainer family, that dynamic plays out in a modern, tragic way. Stephen was, of course, the innocent, the boy who suffered horribly but ultimately became a hero. His story embodied hope, survival, redemption. Whereas Carrie, on the other hand, grew up in that shadow. His life became marked by bitterness and resentment and eventually extreme violence. So it's not that Carrie killed Stephen, like, you know, Cain and Abel, but he didn't. But symbolically, his actions destroyed the peace and hope that Stephen's survival once brought to their family. Both stories involve the same emotional turning point, internal pain turned outward, and Cain's anger at God and his brother culminates in murder, the ultimate attempt to reclaim power. Similarly, Carrie's actions in 99 can be seen as a warped form of control after decades of feeling powerless. He had spent his life surrounded by trauma, first as a bystander to Stephen's kidnapping, and then as someone who never fully recovered from the family's collective grief. But rather than finding healing, he redirected that chaos outward, which the result wasn't just violence. It was violence that stole innocence. Every one of his victims represented the kind of purity and peace that eluded him, right? In Genesis, Cain is marked cursed to wander the earth, bearing the weight of what he has done, and Carrie carries that same kind of symbolic curse. Even in prison, he's haunted by the family name, one that the world associates with both heroism and horror. The Stainer name evokes Stephen's bravery and Carrie's brutality intertwined forever. And for their parents, it was an unbearable duality. One son who had been the victim of unspeakable evil, and another who became the perpetrator of it. At its core, the story of Cain and Abel isn't just about jealousy, it's about how unhealed pain metastasizes. Carrie's crimes don't come from a single moment of rage. They come from years of untreated trauma, isolation, and mental illness. The parallel lies in that buildup. How envy and resentment, left unchecked, can spiral into destruction. Cain took Abel's life, and Carrie took away the peace that his family had fought so hard to regain. So yes, I think in a symbolic sense, the Stainer story is a modern Cain and Abel narrative, only inverted through circumstance, and it's about two brothers marked by tragedy. One who survived unimaginable darkness, and one who became it. Now that's it for today on Mama Mystery. Thank you so much for watching and or listening. And I'll see you back here Friday for the weekly docket, where I'll recap the top headlines for the week in true crime. So make sure you are subscribed or following this show so that you don't miss one of those new episodes. Until then, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.